From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, we'll hear what it's like to look for a place to live after you lose your home to fire.
If they don't rebuild the building, I think we're going to be forced to move out of the Bay Area.
Then we'll find a jazz scene in an unlikely place.
We used to call this the Conservatory of Flowers, and we used to call this the Conservatory of Music.
And we'll check out one of the best smelling plots of land in San Francisco.
The Princess Anne has the nice double-double flower, and it has like all the scent. You can smell it just walking by. So that's my favorite.
Oh.
Go give it a whiff.
Stopping to smell the roses today on Cross Currents. Since 2015, close to 200 people have been displaced by fires in San Francisco's Mission District. At least 58 of those were residents living in a building on the corner of 22nd and Mission that caught fire back in January of 2015. The businesses on the ground were destroyed, and residents were left without permanent homes. One man, Mauricio Orellana, died in the blaze. If you walk by the building today, you'll notice that it's still in disrepair. None of the apartments have been rebuilt so far. So where does that leave displaced residents, especially in one of the most competitive rental markets in the country? We sent KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma to follow up with one of the families impacted by the fire to find out more.
Marcela Cordova had just finished dinner with her daughter when she heard the sirens. They sounded closer and closer, so she told her daughter to stay put and open the front door.
It was like pitch black, and the heat just like hit me in my face. I just remember slamming my door and told my daughter that we had to try to see how we got out because the building was on fire.
Cordova's daughter ran into her bedroom where the fire escape was, but the bars on her window were welded shut.
She starts like pulling in. She was just saying like, we're gonna die. And then I don't know how it just came to my head. I told her to stand in the living room, and I opened the door and I started screaming until the fireman found us.
There was no fire alarms?
No. No fire alarms at all.
The alarms weren't working. The fire escape ladders didn't touch the ground, and one of the exits was padlocked shut. This building had known fire code violations dating back to 2011.
You have all these families, all these kids, and we're living in this building that could just collapse any day.
After the firefighters evacuated the building, Cordova and her family relocated to a shelter at the Salvation Army. Eventually, the city was able to make them an arrangement with the Treasure Island Development Authority to offer them housing at the rate they were previously paying. They've been living on Treasure Island for the last year and a half.
For me, it's hard because I was born and raised in the city. And so to be over here, it's like, this doesn't feel like my home.
There's one small convenience store at the entrance of the island, and that's about it. To do your laundry, you have to go to the city. Public transportation is limited. To get into the East Bay, for instance, you can take the one bus that goes to San Francisco and then BART across the bay. But the fire hasn't just caused inconvenience. It's also caused trauma. It's hard for Cordova to sleep at night.
I can't be in the dark because for some reason it just keeps coming to my head. And I feel like I can't breathe sometimes, so my anxiety is really bad.
One big source of this anxiety, her future housing. Technically, Cordova has the right to return to her building at the same rate she was paying before the fire. But right now, it's a pile of rubble. It's caught fire again since it first burned down, most likely from squatters living there illegally. And the landlord hasn't shown any real initiative to get the building back up and running. Cordova doesn't want to live on Treasure Island forever, so her housing situation is shaky.
If they don't rebuild the building, I think we're going to be forced to move out of the Bay Area.
Where will people go?
Not sure.
And that's the thing. Cordova and her family didn't just lose their home. They lost it in the middle of a housing crisis, which is making it harder for her and all the other families to get back on their feet. Just ask this guy.
I'm Ben Ames, Disaster Response Manager for the San Francisco Human Services Agency.
Ames carries a pager with him everywhere he goes.
There is an event, let's say it's a fire, and I have a pager, and my pager goes off, and I monitor the fire.
After that, he figures out which fire victims need housing through something called the Good Samaritan Tenancy. That's where the city asks landlords to voluntarily offer vacant apartments at the original rate displaced tenants were paying, which means...
the higher the displaced person's rent is, the better success they have with using the Good Samaritan legislation.
The Good Samaritan Tenancy relies on the generosity of landlords. But because of the current housing market, they are more reluctant than ever to give up their space.
This is a business for them, and they don't necessarily want to come and offer up units at substantially reduced costs. So if you have one apartment building and it's your livelihood, this is a big ask from the city.
And on top of that, the Good Samaritan Tenancy is just supposed to be a temporary fix. The reduced rate lasts for 1 year, and then after that, you can renew it for another. And the policy is fairly new, just about 5 years old, which means there isn't exactly a roadmap of what to do when those 2 years are up and there's no apartment to move back to.
I haven't had that issue where people are at the end of their second term of their lease and can't go back.
Hypothetically, a landlord could sit on a ruined property until tenants become priced out of the city, making it harder for families to claim their right to return. A lot of the other families from the 22nd fire are housed by the Good Samaritan Tenancy. I asked Ames, what is going to happen if the building isn't ready by the time the other families' Good Samaritan leases are up?
We have to sit down and have a conversation with my administration and look at this and talk to our political leaders and come up with a decision.
What do you think that's sort of like in an ideal situation would happen?
I don't know.
There have been some changes. This summer, the Board of Supervisors passed legislation to give fire victims priority in the affordable housing lottery. But not only that, landlords now must create an action plan for displaced tenants to give them a better sense of when they might be able to return. In addition, the city set aside $300,000 to help fire victims pay for their housing. But as Ames sees it, true recovery from disaster in the city is all tied up in a greater problem.
San Francisco is very generous. If you need stuff replaced, we can get you a refrigerator, we can get you a mattress, we can get you pots and pans. But because of the housing market, what is the biggest challenge is finding affordable housing. And that is an issue that is way bigger than my office.
San Francisco's housing policies for people displaced by disaster are designed to be temporary. But in this current housing climate, they can feel actively like displacement. Treasure Island is slated for redevelopment, which means Marcela Cordova's home will most likely be torn down in several years. Last week, I checked in with Marcela Cordova. She says that she hasn't been able to find housing in the city since she doesn't qualify for low-income apartments but can't afford to move back.
It doesn't feel like my home, so I don't like to come home.
For now, when she goes to work, she drives close to the neighborhood she grew up and made a home in and returns back to an island in the bay.
There's nothing here. Just a nice view at the entrance.
It's true. From her house, you can see the whole city skyline. It looks close, but it feels far. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma.
San Francisco is a city of art. It's in the murals of the Mission District, the halls of the city's many museums, and sometimes in very unexpected places. That's what KALW's Laura Clivens experienced on a recent bike ride. Here's how it happened.
Sunday mornings are sacred, but not for any religious reason. It's when I head out for a weekly bike ride through Golden Gate Park, west to Ocean Beach. But one weekend, I decide to go on a Saturday instead. I take my usual route, cruising through the aromatic eucalyptus trees along the Panhandle, hugging the curves of John F. Kennedy Drive in Golden Gate Park. And when I arrive at the White Conservatory of Flowers, something's different. On my left, a soothing and out-of-place sound emerges. It's jazz.
We used to call this the Conservatory of Flowers, and we used to call this the Conservatory of Music.
That's Aaron Cohen. I find him with three other musicians playing underground. He's got his hands on a shiny alto saxophone on the southern end of a tunnel, about 50 feet long, that runs under JFK Drive. The musicians are perched on one side of the tunnel.
Some of the stuff I practice, my neighbors wouldn't want to listen to. So you can work out your stuff here. I use it as a rehearsal space.
But you wouldn't guess that. It sounds like a straight-up performance. Paul Corella plays a tenor sax, and he says there's a backstory to this musical gathering.
I remember coming through the park, this is over 10 years ago, and hearing somebody playing guitar. And I came out, and that's where I met Sid, who was a fellow who lives near the park who would use this as his practice room down here. So I brought my horn down, and we played, and then I just started coming down and practicing here if I had some time, because I didn't live too far, and we'd get together on the weekend and play.
When it's not raining or freezing, any number of jazz musicians can be found here on Saturday mornings, improvising melodies and wooing passersby. The musicians say the demand for their music in formal venues has gone down, making the tunnel sessions more significant over the years. Sitting on the steps, I watch as the musicians sway to the music, making eye contact with each other, nodding their heads in time, revealing subtle smiles. They are clearly enjoying themselves, and it draws people in. Couples approach and share a kiss. Young children come and dance. At some point, a family of Spaniards approaches. The father picks up a free guitar and sings a spirited version of Guantanamera that Cohen is happy to accompany on his sax. Corella says this space is key to the magic that they're creating.
The acoustic properties are really something. I mean, I play different spaces, and this has just got a wonderful hang time. It's not too long, just long enough to make the sound. It's very round. Sounds good.
That guy who jumped in to agree is Peter Tittlebach. He's an electric guitar player, originally from the Czech Republic.
It's better than Carnegie Hall or whatever, you know, or Davis, Symphony Davis Hall. It's got better acoustics than Symphony.
It's fun to hang with these guys. They seem like old friends. They say this is where they're free to play around and improvise.
I'd say it is, sure. You know, and if it works for them, you know, then, you know, they'd become, I'm sure, a part of it.
By works for them, he means they need to withstand a democracy, a musical one, that is.
So far, it's like no leader. People just come on their own. You know, nobody tell what we're going to do. You know, and it's some people cannot take it. Like, there was a guitar player, and he said, I cannot play with band which has no leader. And I said, this is most democratic things I can find, you know, because, like, nobody ever, you know, kind of, like, wanna be on top.
I can't imagine who wouldn't love this. But Corella says there are a few downsides, like the chilly wind.
You know, brass instruments really get cold, and they go flat, so you gotta, you know, you have to make up for it by tuning your instrument to to an extreme that makes it sometimes very difficult to play.
And then there's mention of some mosquitoes here and there, and the rare instance of a park ranger visit.
We had a nice crowd here, and we're playing great, and a park ranger came, and he was really feeling guilty about it, but he told us that he said, oh, I'm just telling you, I got a complaint that you have to go. But you don't have to go. You know, he said he was going to call in sick next week so he wouldn't have to do this.
Good call. As it nears 1 o'clock, the wind picks up and the musicians begin to pack up. Their stint here is over this week, but they'll be back next week and the week after. And it's not for any recognition or any tips, actually. Paul Corella says, since it's not a hired gig.
If we blow a few notes here and there, it's okay. It's more about our just getting some experience.
And for people like me, passing by, It's about an experience, too, the one of stumbling across something surprising on a familiar path. In Golden Gate Park, I'm Laura Clivens for Cross Currents.
Sheer Elegance, Wild Blue Yonder, Lady Elsie May, Daybreaker. Although these might sound like romance novel titles, they're actually names for different species of the flower of romance, the rose. San Francisco's Golden Gate Park has one whole acre of land dedicated to roses. We sent KLW's Chris Hambrick to sniff out the story.
This is an oasis of color and smell. It's popular among tourists and honeybees, too. Fuchsia, red, peach, yellow, and white blooms explode everywhere around me. Andy Stone, the Rose Garden supervisor, tells me more.
The Rose Garden is divided into 64 beds, each with a different variety of rose, usually 12 roses to a bed. And then there's the beds on the side that have the climbers and the old-fashioned roses.
The garden's been around since 1961. That's when the American Rose Society's San Francisco chapter went looking for a space to test different varieties in a cool, moist climate. Most of the roses here are hybrids that have been donated. Before we get going on our tour, I have to ask.
What's so special about roses?
They are the queen of the flowers. They're just one of the most beautiful flowers of the garden.
We stroll across the lush lawn to get to know some of these beauties a little better. Stone stops at one of his favorites.
So this one is Julia Child, and this type of rose is called a floribunda. It has many, many flowers on each spike, and they're somewhat fragrant, but what I like most is that they bloom so heavily. They bloom very heavily, they have very healthy leaves, they're not affected by very many pests.
Oh, it smells fantastic. What color would you call that? I'm saying yellow, but it's more complex than that.
Oh, it's gold. It's a golden color. It's kind of buttery. Julia liked so much butter on everything, so this, I think of Julia's buttery chicken with this one.
Speaking of butter, I noticed the other roses that remind me of food, like the Cherry Parfait. It's a white rose with red-edged petals, while the Rainbow Sorbet is a golden flower with red-orange blush on the tips. For our next stop, Stone takes us to the area where climbing roses wind around lattice borders.
This is a very old rose called Rosa Eglantine, and that would be grown in England on the old castles, or in Ireland growing up over the castles, and it grows quite tall. I'd almost like to let it go up and climb up the redwood trees. This one here is a briar rose, and it makes nice big rose hips, and these are sometimes actually used for jam.
This one looks like tissue paper. What's that one?
That's another briar rose. And it's this simple old-fashioned rose, just one row of petals, five petals.
I leave Stone to do some of my own nosing around.
Whoa. The Wild Blue Yonder has the distinct rose smell that I love. That one might be my favorite because of the smell. Strike it rich. Oh, this one is really tall. I think it's probably called Strike It Rich because it's super gold.
I see someone with clippers. It's Stephen Childers. He's the rose gardener. And of course, he has his favorite.
Princess Anne is the second one from the front. It's a purple, older English variety of rose with a really great scent. And that's one of the reasons why I like it so much.
Surprisingly, not all roses have a scent, and during hybridization, it can fade as growers focus on taller, hardier plants.
The newer roses have a really showy display, but there's no scent to them, and that for me kind of takes away part of what makes a rose so cool, is the fragrance of it. So the Princess Anne has the nice double-double flower, and it has like all the scent. You can smell it just walking by, so that's my favorite.
Oh.
Go give it a whiff.
I smell everything I can, and the wonderful ones twice.
Polka iceberg.
For Cross Currents, I'm Chris Hambrick, smelling the roses.
Find more stories online at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. For KALW News, I'm Hannah Baba.